Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, there were some big, big news stories this week, of course. That goes without saying, but I said it anyway. The swine flu outbreak, H1N1, Senator Arlen Specter's departure from the Republican Party, President Obama's first 100 days in office. But that wasn't all the news that was fit to print, not even close. What about the fact that the Obama administration is still claiming state secrets privilege in some key detainee civil rights cases? Meanwhile, the Senate kowtows to bankers and refuses to make it easier for you, the homeowner, to avoid foreclosures if you're in bankruptcy. Have you heard about these stories? No? Well, joining us to take a look at the news food chain, what gets on the news cycle and what doesn't, is Mark Jerkowitz. He's the Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. And joining us to talk about the stories that should have made the headlines this week is Salon columnist Glenn Greenwald. Mark, let me start with you. What news did we miss this week because of the big headlines?
Well, interestingly enough, what might have happened and the tendency that we tend to see in our evaluation of news coverage is that some of the big headlines of this week probably were a little smaller than they would have otherwise been, frankly, because of the swine flu. We have something called the News Coverage Index, and we measure basically what stories are being produced by the mainstream media, and I should say that this is the mainstream media, on a weekly basis. And while our week is still going on, it's clear this week that the predominant story by far has been the swine flu crisis.
Right.
What's gotten secondary coverage? The stories you just mentioned. The Arlen Specter defection to the Democratic Party. To some degree, the focus on the first 100 days of the Obama administration, which some can argue is a hallmark holiday and some consider to be important. The troubled economy, the situation with Chrysler. These are all stories that have trailed the swine flu significantly. And based on the trends that we have seen in news coverage in recent years, the bigger likelihood, had there been no swine flu story to cover this week, is that stories like Obama's first 100 days or Specter's defection or the Chrysler story would have actually been bigger. So, my hypothesis would be that these second, third, and fourth stories would have actually sucked more of the oxygen out of the room.
Would have been bigger. Well, Glenn Greenwald from Salon.com, you think that we in the media or the mainstream media like to chase other kinds of stories like the Craigslist killer and sort of more sensationalistic stories? Do you think without H1N1 that the situation would have been any different this week in terms of coverage?
I think yes and no. I think certainly if there weren't these obsessions with stories that are very melodramatic, that get the fear levels high and pumping, that there would be opportunities to cover more substantive and truly consequential stories. At the same time, the two stories that you identified at the beginning as ones that didn't really receive any sort of attention, namely the fact that Obama is embracing many of the most radical Bush theories of shielding presidential actions from any sort of legal scrutiny or judicial review, and the fact that the Senate essentially is controlled by the bankers, by the banking industry that spawned the financial crisis, and that's not me saying that the number two senator in the United States Senate, Dick Durbin, said, quote, this place is owned by the bankers. Those are the kinds of stories that I think mainstream media tends to avoid in the first case, because things like constitutional rights and abuses of government power are things that are complicated and not particularly interesting to most media stars. And I think the second, that the U.S. Congress is controlled by the people who pour money into their coffers, that it's literally an intrinsically corrupt institution, is something that people in the media simply don't believe and consider to be so normalized that it's not really worth reporting.
Right. Well, Mark, it's been a big, interesting, harried week for news. H1N1, Arlen Specter, Obama's first 100 days. So it has been a big news week with lots of important stories. Certainly swine flu is incredibly important. But a few weeks ago, I remember stories, everybody obsessing over the Obama's dog, right? And mm-hmm. those stories that do make it to the top of the headlines. They're fun and they're cute and fuzzy, just like the dogs. The stories are too. But what consequence do stories like that have? Is it all obfuscation and marketing by the White House? What does it do to us as news consumers when stories like that rise to the top of the headlines?
Well, we have to put Bo in a little bit of perspective, which is that Bo did get a lot of coverage, and there are a lot of tabloid editors and editors elsewhere who would tell you you can never go wrong putting an animal on page one. It did not dominate the news agenda the week that the Bo story came out. And, you know, there are a lot of definitions of news, and not all of them have to be eating our vegetables. I'm all for covering the most significant things that can conceivably have the most impact on the most people and that people should know about. And so Bo becomes nothing more than a sideshow, obviously. But it did not dominate the news cycle. One story, I think, that did dominate the news cycle in a couple of recent weeks that's worth talking about in that light is sort of the Somali pirate story.
Right.
Which sort of sprung from nowhere of all the foreign policy crises that the president was supposed to be facing. This was not one that was anticipated. And for 2 weeks in a row, that was a dominant story. Now, obviously, there was a dramatic event that included the rescue of Captain Phillips. But, you know, there's a lot of argument that, you know, there's something sort of subliminally voyeuristic about the idea of pirates and high seas thievery. And there's a legitimate question there, frankly, about is the threat really overblown? Is this really a huge foreign policy crisis? But that's the kind of story that had a lot of sort of diverse elements in it, including conflict and drama, that really did dominate the news cycle for a couple of weeks. So I think you could make an argument about just how significant a story it was.
And one of the really important aspects of that story, of course, is that Somalia as a failed state. I mean, that had sort of crept into the news agenda with some news outlets looking at that, and then it kind of went away again, and nobody wanted to talk about what's happening in the Horn of Africa.
That's exactly. I mean, that story quickly became. I mean, it took two forms. One was sort of the human interest story, that was very obviously U.S. centric about the captain and the crew. And the other was sort of, well, what do we do next? You know, then it suddenly became is this a geopolitical threat? How do we get these guys? Do we hit them at their base in Somalia? But there was very little coverage about sort of the root causes of that. I would agree on that.
All right. Well, Glenn, let me bring you in here real quickly, just because we're going to wrap pretty soon. I want to ask you about H1N1 and the way it's been covered. It's obviously a big story verging on a pandemic. It's obviously going to make news. What do you make of the quality of the coverage to stop flu? Of course, if people do basic things like wash their hands, stay home if they're sick, we can head off these infections and epidemics. Has the media conveyed that accurately, or have they been too sensationalistic? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. It's a story. I think that there's no perspective on it, though. And what happens is that it ends up being distorted given how much attention is paid. I mean, there's no question that it has the potential to be a serious pandemic. At the same time, most of these types of medical issues where diseases spread slowly, the way it's spreading slowly, end up being very mild.
All right.
And the implications and consequences limited.
All right. Well, thanks. Glenn Greenwald with Salon.com. He's a columnist. Thanks for joining us. Mark Jerkowitz, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism, Daljit.
Well, you know, it's been widely reported that the Supreme Court Justice David Souter is expected to retire in June, and this is after more than almost 20 years on the job. We want to know, what do you think? Who do you think that President Obama should nominate to take his place? And we received this from a listener on Twitter. Columbia professor Patricia Williams should be the replacement, moving the court to the right direction, to the left.
Well, that's one. Thank you, Patricia, for your response. We want to hear from you at 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.